Welcome to this episode of the Multicultural Middle Ages podcast. I'm Amy Juarez, one of your co-hosts for today's episode. I'm a PhD candidate in the English department at the University of California, Riverside, which is situated on the unceded homeland of the Tongva, Kuwia, Serrano, and Luseno peoples and their ancestors past, present, and future. My research is focused on medieval literature and culture, the visual arts, and embodiment. I'm interested in examining how medieval architectural discourses inform literary descriptions of bodies and of buildings, exploring overlapping technologies of bodily, material, and rhetorical care.
I am another of your co-hosts. My name is Chelsea Keane. I'm also a PhD candidate in English at UC Riverside. My dissertation research looks at literary environments in medieval and early modern literature, particularly how they are fashioned with rhetorics and ideologies of extraction. And I also work a bit in the fields of medievalism and media studies, thinking about how world building and cinematographic strategies and technique are used in filmic medievalism to construct environments in their respective cinema genres.
Our discussion today revolves around the central question: how does thinking about the interplay and relationship between built and natural medieval environments help us think in new ways about contemporary social and environmental concerns? To explore the complex and interwoven relationship between space, place, and people, we'll work through literary and theoretical understandings of the medieval environment, whether that's artificial, natural, or anything in between, while considering ethical and practical ways of applying our thoughts in modern, public-facing ways.
The goal of this episode is to think with listeners about these aspects of medieval literature from a transhistorical perspective, which in turn allows us to examine the relevance of these topics for our moment of climate catastrophe, environmental racism, etc. Today, we are super lucky to be joined by Dr. Rebecca Davis, an associate professor of English at the University of California, Irvine. Thank you so much for joining us. Do you mind introducing yourself and your research?
Hi, everyone. And thanks so much, Chelsea and Amy, for inviting me to join you today. Well, my research has chiefly centered on representations of nature and the more than human world in Middle English, especially in the great literative poem Piers Plowman. So my first book, Piers Plowman and the Books of Nature, which was also my dissertation, got started because I was fascinated by this recurring figure in Piers Plowman called kind, or kinde, which means nature in Middle English, as many of you may know. But in this poem, this figure functions as a representation of the Christian creator god. And this was really amazing to me because up to this point in the Latin and French tradition, nature had been personified as female, as the goddess Natura. So my book set out to place Langland's personification within these literary traditions and think about the stakes involved in making nature masculine and, well, making nature God. That is, conflating the distinction between creator and creation and bringing the divine near to human experience.
What directions has your work taken since Piers Plowman and the Books of Nature?
Well, since I finished that project, you know, whoever really finishes with Langland, I guess you could say. But I've continued to think about nature and materiality, creativity, working on projects about dynamic forms in Chaucer's House of Fame. And recently, I did a short piece about the material agency of spices and the conjunction of literary and culinary texts. But my current book project is a bit of a departure, though it actually did stem from the work I did on House of Fame. In that piece, I was interested in fluid and porous forms, you know, the idea that you have this received plot, the Aeneid, but you want to take it and do something different with it, to shake up the fixed and kind of stifling forms of tradition, which Chaucer represents there with the Temple of Venus. So I was thinking a lot about the very Chaucerian question: how do we make space for something new, while, of course, building on what came before? Can old stories change? My new project, which I'm calling Graceful Narratives, explores how the theological idea of grace, which is based on a logic of surplus, influenced literary production, specifically by catalyzing narrative forms that are nonlinear or that suspend time in some way, opening up possibilities for change and new directions. I've found that when writers are thinking about grace, they often produce these dilated narratives that become literary dwelling places. In a sense, they make space and time. And in doing so, I argue that they answer to a critical intellectual and social need for a space of deliberation, both for the characters within the diegetic frames of their narratives and for audiences beyond them.
What I see in your work is the methodology that engages deeply with medieval material to demonstrate that an assumption we might carry about the relationship between allegory and material, for instance, or the nature of narrative, is actually much more complex and interwoven. And that stands out to me because, Amy, your current work on medieval literature looks at architectural discourse, while mine uses environmental humanities frameworks. And at first blush, this seems to put us on totally opposite sides of that infamous and highly debunked nature-culture divide. But even though we tend to work on quote-unquote built and quote-unquote natural environments respectively, we're constantly talking about how interrelated our fields and our work are. We even have dissertation chapters on the exact same text, but we have our approaches, right? So I'm really excited to be in conversation with you both. Becky, your work itself exemplifies in practice how we can approach literary and cultural concepts from long ago in ways that are both grounded in medieval thought and text, and yet not mired down by preconceived notions of fixity and tradition.
I couldn't agree more that medieval narratives can often surprise us by thwarting our expectations. And your point about assumptions of linearity is a great example of that. Medieval literature is so experimental when it comes to narrative structure and temporality. I also love the idea that the two of you are, in a sense, bookends to one another. One of you focuses on the built environments and the other focuses on the natural ones. But I think today we're really going to destabilize that distinction.
Since the three of us are literary scholars, perhaps we can start by thinking about words themselves and also defining precisely what, quote, natural and built environments consist of, both for the sake of our conversation, but also as a way to use this distinction in order to complicate binaries rather than reify or reinscribe them.
That's a great starting point, Chelsea. Are there particular frameworks that you have found formative and maybe useful when thinking about these definitions?
A chapter that really fundamentally affected the way I see myself as a scholar of environmental humanities was Levi Bryant's chapter called Black in Jeffrey Jerome Cohen's edited collection Prismatic Ecology, where each chapter in that collection uses a different color as a framework for expanding our conception of what constitutes ecology beyond the color green. Lawrence Buell wrote a foreword for the collection that suggests that thinking of ecology only as green nature, quote, perpetuates the implication of binary nature-culture separation, end quote. And one of the things that Bryant's chapter emphasizes is that ecology is not solely about what we call nature. What he says is, quote, to think ecologically is not to think nature per se, but to think relations between things. What happens when things relate? What happens when relations are severed, and positive and negative feedback loops that emerge in interactions between things.
Thanks for bringing this framework in, Chelsea. It's super interesting, and it makes me think about the ways in which this might inform or materialize in your teaching. Do you see that working in the ways you work with students and get them to think about their relationships between themselves and their own environments?
I found it to be a really useful foundation to think about all types of environments with, natural, built,
social, right? Everything that we can think of as being an ecosystem. When I talk about this with students in the classroom, I ask them to use our campus as an example to learn how to think about relationships this way. We have the built environment of our building and our physical room, which organizes our social ecosystem of the classroom. In a built environment, like a 300 person lecture hall, is gonna result in a really different social ecosystem than a small 20 person room, for instance. And then UC Riverside in specific is nestled right against the Box Springs Mountain, which sort of loom over campus, and they remind us about the natural environment that the built environment of campus has displaced or is sort of encroaching upon. And this framing of real world relationality between types of environments on our campus ends up transitioning really well into talking about, just to take an example that starts off most BritLit survey classes, a text like Beowulf, where we have these complex interactions between the social ecosystems of the Danes and Beowulf within the built environment of Hrothgar's Mead Hall, which is imposed upon the natural environment where Grendel and his mother live. And by virtue of the fact that Grendel attacks the built environment of the Mead Hall because of the ways its noise pollution seeps onto his land, we know intuitively that these registers of social built and natural ecosystems are not distinct from one another, but they're really deeply related. Not necessarily harmoniously related, but related.
I love both of these examples. The really relatable one about the classrooms and campus environments, and the literary one. It's so tempting, isn't it, to read the worlds of the Mead Hall and the Mere as fundamentally opposed. But I think you're right that it's a fallacy. The relationship of the two realms and what they represent is much more dynamic than that.
This complex and perhaps not so separate relationship between natural and built that you're speaking to, Chelsea, makes me think about the Green Chapel in Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. You know, there's the built space that's called a chapel, which would hold in it the sort of image or the connotation of pristine, built, ornamented space. But in reality, it's a cave or a barrow situated in the midst of this expansive, overgrown, and literally green environment. And so, though it's not imposed into the landscape in quite the same way that the Mead Hall is in Beowulf, I think it represents what you mentioned, Becky, that these kinds of spaces aren't fundamentally opposed in ways they might initially appear to be, and that it's precisely this kind of seepage between understandings of natural and built that give us a productive rubric for thinking about medieval environments holistically.
Even when it comes to actual individual Middle English words, I think we can see a complex reckoning with the space between types of environments or ecosystems. The various connotations and associations of a single word can speak to larger registers of how medieval language can demonstrate complex thinking about relationships between entities rather than clean binaries and distinctions between them. Becky, as our book expertly demonstrates, one of the very best words to demonstrate that in action is kind, or kinda.
Yeah, kinda is such a fascinating word. For one thing, it's insular, as opposed to the Latinate nature, which was also in use by English speakers at this time. But kinda insists on drawing attention to the intimacy, even the naturalness, of the vernacular language. In his landmark book, Keywords, Raymond Williams calls nature, quote, perhaps the most complex word in the language, end quote. But I'd argue that kinda is even more complex than its Latinate cousin. You know, like nature, kinda encompasses the whole scope of creation. It can mean cosmos, that is, the whole universe, but it also points to inherent qualities of individual components of creation. So we can speak of the kinda or nature of a particular creature, be it a human or a non-human animal, or the kinda of a plant, or say a particular type of rock. Like nature, kinda can describe material things as well as non-material ones, such as instinctive behaviors like the sexual drive, as well as more spiritual aspects of human and divine natures, including that of God and the soul. So both nature and kinda as terms run the gamut. But it's here where I think we really begin to see the more expansive potential of kinda versus nature. As our modern usage of the term suggests, kinda indicates a capacity for innate moral and ethical feeling. It's rooted in the Old English word kund, a cognate of kin, meaning kin or people. And because of this link to kinship, kinda has a strong social and ethical valence. As Andy Galloway has shown really wonderfully, one of the meanings of kindness is gratitude, suggesting that it is natural, that is both instinctive and proper, to reciprocate gifts of love and goods, and that by extension it is unnatural, indeed unkind, not to do so.
Oh wow, so this is where we get our modern concept of being kind.
Yeah, exactly. And what I love about kind is the way it ties together the whole universe, divine and human, matter and spirit, sexuality and ethics, in one expansive semantic web. Kind is a thread that runs through everything. In this way, it's really an ecological worldview. There's a darker side of kinda. The concept can be used to exclude as much as to include. For example, in many texts, you find references to our kind versus their kind, a formulation that can be used to alienate on the basis of religion or ethnicity, or to underscore a firm boundary between human and non-human creatures, thus promoting notions of human exceptionalism.
Thinking about these multiple valences of Middle English words is great, because when I read that Bryant chapter that I mentioned a few minutes ago, it seemed really methodologically revolutionary to me to think of ecosystems and environments beyond the green as what happens when things relate. And I do still think that it is, but kinda, this word that is also a concept that is morphing and growing and shrinking as it applies to different situations, it actually completely embodies that idea of relations between things. And a different word that still speaks to multiplicity in its definition, I think, is earth. In the Middle English text series introduction to the famous Harley lyric, Earth Toke of Earth, it says that the lyric's repetition of its key words is a series of, quote, dense, repetitive, often bewildering puns, end quote. It's very funny. And I find it to be a really good description, because finding something bewildering seems like a fantastic spot to start thinking about how that single word is pushing its linguistic boundaries, especially since multiplicity of meaning is really the crux on which that lyric's entire meaning turns. And since it's so short, four lines, should we actually just read it right now?
Earth, talk of earth, earth with woe, earth, other earth to the earth draw, earth laid earth in earthen throw, though heavy earth of earth, earth e know.
The benefit of medieval lyric is that they can be so brief that we can just afford time to read them in entirety. We can hear how many times earth comes up in those lines. Three repetitions in every single line. And in the space of those four lines, that single word refers to soil, dirt, this earthly ground that we walk on, people themselves, their possessions, and then finally their tombs. So with each repetition, it's enacting a specific and distinct meaning, but the overall effect is one where we see enmeshment between entities via the specific linguistic and repetitive strategy.
It's useful to think of these categories as distinct. On the one hand, the natural world, i.e. for a medieval Christian, what God made, and on the other, the built world, i.e. what human beings make, or even we might say what human beings do with the natural world with which God endowed humankind. But in practice, these two realms get productively blurred in medieval texts.
That's a great point, Becky. Do you feel like there's a certain setting that might best exemplify how this blurring occurs?
Yeah, well, take the garden, for example. This is a mainstay of medieval romance, a place that, as the locus amenus, calls back to the perfection of the primordial Garden of Eden. Gardens are places where lovers meet or where visions take place. They're often hailed as natural spaces, places set apart, even walled off from society at large and its artificial conventions and strictures. In the garden, sensory pleasures and the rhythms of nature might alter the ordinary rules of social engagement. But gardens, of course, are planned, often intricately so, and they must be cultivated and tended. They are as much artificial spaces as natural ones, and as such, they suggest a paradigm of the eco-critical truism that there is no separating nature from culture and vice versa. Or as Timothy Morton puts it in his book, Ecology Without Nature, we'll never arrive at a genuine ecological vision as long as we think of nature as a space apart, an idealized pure realm. This fiction gets in the way of truly seeing the fact of our entanglement.
This notion of the designed garden brings to mind technologies of craft or manufacturing in a text like Troilus and Cressade, where Pandarus orchestrates the lovers' meeting in and through various spatial or environmental logics that lead to this kind of productive blurring of boundaries. Early in book one, when he's talking about orchestrating their union, Pandarus says he will send out his Hartes Lina to plan his scheme, in the very same way that a builder would anticipate or imagine a building to be erected. This is based on Geoffrey of Insoft's notion of poetry and rhetoric being linked to processes of building and developing that concept of poet as master builder. Pandarus uses the image of the lovers as a construction project, but his materials, Troilus and Cressade, are organic and natural, and so they alter, as you say, Becky, Pandarus's rules of engagement, or his sort of mastery over the building materials and their constructed or expected outcome. This is only one example of the way that Pandarus orchestrates and or facilitates the union of the lovers in and through both built and natural environments. He also has them meet and interact in the window scene where Cressade is seated on a seat looking out her window to see Troilus out in the streets, and it represents this collapsing of inner and outer because Troilus is in the natural world of the open air streets and Cressade is in the internal structures of the house. I'm wondering if, like Pandarus, we can conceptualize the process of designing or orchestrating or building even as a porous and or permeable process. And are there other frameworks of craft that speak to this relationship between nature and culture in medieval contexts or by medieval authors?
For me, a useful trope for conceptualizing the relationship between nature and culture, or natural and built environments, or between any conceivable binary terms, really, is the Middle English notion of the devise. Here I go again with etymologies, but really they're very important to us as medievalists. You know, the word devise comes from the verb devisen, which essentially means to design, but can also mean to divide. So the noun devise can refer to a design, a plan, or even a work of art, as well as a boundary or division. I'm part of a research community right now at UCI called Medieval Devisings, which my colleagues Elizabeth Allen and Hugh Roberts and I started a few years ago. We take our name from the term as it appears in the Middle English poem Pearl, when the grieving speaker first sees the pearl maiden across a river that divides his world from hers. I'll read a couple of lines from the poem where he reacts to perceiving that division. He thought that paradise was there over yen do banca so brada, he hoped the water were a devise between merthes be meres mada. So that is, he thought paradise was over there on the other side of the bank. He interprets the river as a boundary separating him from joys, merthes, mirths. And he understands the river as a division created by the pooling waters. And thinking about this term, though, what we came to realize was so fascinating about the idea of divise as boundary is that a boundary is not just a barrier. It's always a point of connection, too. Pearl belongs to the visionary genre. And through the medium of the vision, the speaker is given privileged knowledge about the kingdom of heaven where his lost pearl now dwells. It is true that he's not permitted to cross the river, so it is a hard boundary in that way. But that doesn't mean that he's left with nothing. His vision gives him privileged, though not full, knowledge of heaven. So I like to use the concept of devising as a way, I guess, to soften up boundaries. It reminds us that boundaries aren't absolute. But for our research cluster at UCI, this means we can seek out devisings between historical periods and invite our colleagues across different temporal and disciplinary fields into conversations with the medieval. And then going back to that idea of the garden, we might think of it as a devise. It is planned and designed, a product of human artifice or cultivation, but it is also a point of connection between the natural and the cultural that, rather than uphold the fiction of their absolute division, brings them together, really showing us in a physical space the fact that they are always already co-implicated.
The way you were explaining that made me think of one of Frederick Furnival's forewords to Chaucer's Complaint of Mars. Furnival co-founded and contributed to the Oxford English Dictionary and the Early English Text Society, and he's an early editor of Chaucer. And his forewords, they're famous for being like highly overly personal and also slightly stream of consciousness. And one of the things he writes in the foreword to Complaint of Mars is that he is, quote, among bluebells, honeysuckles, laburnums, cuckoos, and nightingales, Chaucer's daisies under my feet, his heavenly harmony of birds about me, and his bright old England all around, end quote. Stephanie Trigg has written that Furnival uses these forewords to commune with Chaucer. This foreword was introduced to me by Chris Queen, who writes about how Furnival uses these forewords to disturb the temporal distance between himself and Chaucer.
That's such a striking and poignant image of historical yearning. You know, as medievalists, our authors are all so dead.
Like, spoiler alert for the listener, all of these authors are dead. But they're yet not dead at all in our cultural conversation. As Robin Bartlett's recent Exemplaria article on Chaucer, Raptus, and the Physician's Tale really shows us in a very poignant way. Furnival saw Chaucer all around him, in the countryside in particular. And just as like a fun side note, in the city of London, he felt more connected to Hockleave, or at least he felt like he understood Hockleave better there in the city. So he's using different types of environments to connect to different medieval poets. And he uses the garden-like imagery evoked by Chaucer's verses, Chaucer's daisies under my feet, he says, as a sort of devising to connect them across time. Furnival already imagines a personal similarity between himself and Chaucer across time, and then this garden imagery becomes the way to devise connection across temporal separation.
Chelsea, if I recall, you also use a particular metaphor quite a lot in your own work for talking about this kind of contact across boundaries, don't you?
Yes, I do. And huge shout out to one of my top three favorite theoretical frameworks ever, which is Steve Mentz's theorization of SEEP in the edited collection Veer Ecology. This has helped me think about how entities can interact with one another without losing what makes that entity individual, but also not pretending that entities aren't changed by interaction. Mentz discusses the relationship between allegory and its material referent. That's what he discusses in specific, but I think that we can apply that theory of SEEP beyond the allegorical to relationships between things in general. He argues that thinking via seep between entities highlights, quote, fluid processes of contact and exchange that erase boundaries that were once deemed solid, while emphasizing that, given the slow diffusion of seeping's actions, rough differences and separations remain. This model emphasizes that all substances, from water to rock to flame, flow and seep as liquids under the proper conditions and pressures, end quote. Like Devise, the type of relationship between entities that is described by seep becomes key to how we understand many types of things in medieval literature, ranging from relationships between built and natural entities to even medieval genres like allegory themselves.
This makes me wonder about how boundaries function poetically or formally. Since we're talking about the ways in which medieval authors might play with permeable conceptions of built, natural, and especially rhetorical space as a third kind of environment to add to the conversation. And one example this brings to mind is, once again, Troilus and Cressid, because there's this moment early in Book One where Chaucer plays with a permeable understanding of built, human, and rhetorical form. And Troilus, it's when he's experiencing one of his first bouts of lovesickness, is shown to be wailing in his chamber, he's alone, in distress, and in need of care. But then it flips to Pandarus's perspective, and it's not until Pandarus actually sees Troilus at the very end of the stanza that he understands it is actually the prince who's the one in need of care and comfort. I read this moment as Pandarus having uncertainty around whether it is Troilus or the chamber who weeps, precisely because the poetic form suspends his own discovery of the saddened prince. This moment also mimics the poem's very first stanza, which ruminates on how the speaker's words will themselves weepen as Eurita, as Chaucer or the speaker discusses Troilus's misery. The result of each of these moments is a porous boundary between varying kinds of form, which makes me think of your work, Becky, on the House of Fame. You talk about how, in its reckoning of lively matter, the poem offers a kind of softened boundary, a divisa or a seep, around natural and built environments with the Temple of Venus, the Wicker House, and the icy foundations of the House of Fame itself. So Becky, I'm wondering if you can speak more about how form, whether that's poetic, human, inhuman, etc., works like kinda or divisa as a fluid and non-restrictive tool to think about poetic boundaries in the House of Fame.
I see House of Fame as fundamentally a poem about motion, or more precisely, about Chaucer's recognition that his poetic materials are always in motion. That is, I'm thinking about his materials as encompassing, you know, the old stories that circulate and reverberate, mixing lies with truth, but also the very matter of language itself and the means by which it travels in speech and in writing. All of these things in the House of Fame are presented as fugitive, like Aeneas, always en route between places. So think, for example, as you mentioned, Amy, of the icy foundation in Fame's house, where the names are melting away in the sun. This situation, though, I think is a good problem to have in Chaucer's view. The solution toward which the House of Fame points is not finally to try to fix matter, but instead to invent literary forms that accommodate its dynamism.
I desperately wish that we knew the ending to this poem, but this is also one of those moments where I kind of don't wish that, because the unfinished ending actually means that matter really isn't fixed at all.
I don't think it's meant to have any other ending, personally. For me, this hole at the end of the text is as necessary as the holes in the Wicker House. That's how the design of the poem works.
With that design in mind, with no definite endpoint, we can really see how the motion of story becomes eternal, almost. Of these environments that are there in the poem, what is happening with form as that poem progresses?
Well, I think we can read the poem's three major edifices as moving toward these more accommodating poetic forms, and ultimately pointing toward the multivocalic poem in motion that we know as the Canterbury Tales. So first, the Temple of Venus, as I suggested earlier, is monumental and more or less stable, but it's also stifling for the narrator. He leaves it after reading the story of the Aeneid, seeking what he calls a stirring man, someone alive, someone stirring. He wants companionship, another voice. The House of Fame itself is certainly both lively and crowded, but its capricious operations don't satisfy him either. It's finally in that third environment, the Whirling Wicker House, which some people refer to as the House of Tidings, that the narrator witnesses a model of a truly dynamic poetic form. And I think notably for our interests here, this is an edifice that is truly an amalgam of the natural and the cultural. It's impossible to decide whether it's a built environment or a natural one. This final space in the poem is essentially a woven basket. And Chaucer compares it, in fact, to baskets and wicker carrying cases. It's made of twigs of every color, and far from being a fixed edifice like Venus's temple, it's full of holes that allow dynamic matter to enter freely and then freely to go out again, albeit in a changed form. So this lively wicker form works precisely because it fails to contain, precisely because it is porous and pliable. I think this structure is a model for the kind of poetic form that Chaucer is dreaming about in the House of Fame.
That note about entering freely and exiting in changed form is vital because we too are inevitably changed as we encounter other entities, be they environments, places, people, or literary forms. One of my favorite lines in the section you're talking about is where Chaucer lists these things the house is full of, and he concludes by saying, on of many other workings. And that is a reminder for me that the plane of human observation and experience and what is delivered to the reader via poetic form really only skims the surface of what is actually extant in the world. As for what is visible to us as readers, how writers organize form can obviously tell us a lot about how they're organizing larger social and cultural matters too.
Form has a restrictive and or hierarchizing ability to it. And this is, you know, reminiscent of, as you mentioned, Becky, the less rosy side of Kinda, where it operates or functions as a means to delineate, you know, our kind versus your kind, our Kinda versus your Kinda. I'm thinking here specifically about built form and the way that it attempts to organize or collect, maintain, upkeep, and preserve a very particular version or vision of the thing it actually forms, which means that it inherently also works to mitigate and organize against variants or variant forms and patterns. Take Christine de Pizan's The Book of the City of Ladies, in which Christine constructs an imagined city using the bodies of various ladies that she herself deems or finds valuable or important. She forms her city according to a rubric that prioritizes placing very particular kinds of female bodies, those that are white and intelligent, in the most visible parts of the city, at the tops of the city walls, at the facade of the city, right, literally the face of the city, while at the same time, she places those outside of these aesthetic categories, dark and or black female bodies, within the covert spaces of the city and as pillars and caryatids that actually hold up the city proper. In this example, there's a blurring happening between material form, stony or rocky matter, and human form, when the ladies become these actual building materials. And more overtly, form operates here as a racial category to, as Geraldine Heng puts it, structure difference, both literally and metaphorically.
There's a big body of work on Pizan, and a significant portion of it thinks about how she conceptualizes the vital position of women within a medieval framework. But thinking about it in this intersectional way, I think, demands that we think about who is made invisible in literary constructions, let alone society at large. Pizan is this paragon of medieval women's writing, and the way that she maps and constructs her city of ladies is astounding. But in this framing, it's done at the expense of racialized folks. We live in a country that is built on systematic oppression and the labor of enslaved folks. She is literally building her city on marginalized bodies.
This collapsing of racialized bodies onto stony matter also brings to mind how we discuss overlapping discourses of vitality, materiality, and the inhuman. Jane Bennett's work on Lively Matter feels a fitting framework to add to the conversation because she talks about how objects, space, and inanimate matter are always already actants. Or perhaps how Jeffrey Jerome Cohen, speaking more specifically about a kind of material object, stone, says that stone always draws us to invoke it, to project onto it, to imagine with it, and thus sort of situates a sort of non-hierarchical or lateral connection between human and inhuman. And at the same time, there's this obvious ethical quandary around philosophies of animacy, because these kinds of frameworks do and can privilege the inanimate over real lived material beings. And in Pizan's case, medieval understandings of vibrancy are used to further mark racialized and marginalized bodies.
The idea that environments, both natural and built, affect humans is undebatable. And they affect different communities differently depending on cultural constructions, both now and in medieval literature. In Dante's Inferno, for instance, in every circle of hell, the non-human entities and environments participate in the poem's contrapasso, which is the name for the tortures or punishment for someone's sin that is related to the nature of the sin itself. But the nature of that quote-unquote sin sometimes depends on one's identity groups. So a sin could be being pagan, and what that really means is like not believing in Dante's 14th century Catholic God, whether because they're actually pagan, a pre-Christian Greek, or they practice a different kind of monotheistic religion like Islam. The environments in different circles of hell do act upon the human shades who are sometimes placed in these environments simply because of an identity group they belong to. But in practice, in the poem, this usually means that non-white, non-Christians experience more intense or adverse environmental phenomenon than white European Christians, even within Inferno itself. But that said, this is a medieval example in which environments do act or become divinely animated according to certain 14th century cultural paradigms. The piece I reflect on often when I think about things like this is Dr. Mark Minch de Leon's 2021 article, Atlas for a Destroyed World, in the journal Native American and Indigenous Studies, where he discusses how Kim Tallbear discusses the way that, quote, broader notions of vitality, and that I take to mean vitalism as strictly theory outside of context-specific and context-driven milieus, comes close to an Indigenous metaphysics as outlined by someone like Vine Deloria Jr., but only to approximate it as theory and methodology. And Minch de Leon says that this unanchored and uncontextualized vitalism can too easily be co-opted into a, quote, discourse that furtively borrows Indigenous perspectives and universalizes and secularizes them as a form of vitalist critique, end quote. I think that really gets to the heart, Amy, of what you mean by the ethical quandary of animism or vitality. As scholars of medieval literature who seriously think about how built and natural environments and material might act independent of or in relation to medieval cultural communities, how do we approach these texts and the environments therein without co-opting or furtively borrowing a certain discourse, to use Minch de Leon's words?
We do need to be very aware of appropriation, particularly when ideas go uncredited or, say, when Indigenous concepts are casually adopted as a frame to exploit without commitment to a deep and sensitive understanding of the culture it comes from. That said, I also think that there are ways of doing a responsible, context-specific, and or cross-cultural study of ideas about material agency. Animistic ideas are intrinsic to medieval European thought as well. Just to give one example, and this is to build on our rock bibliography, Amy already mentioned Jeffrey Jerome Cohen's work on stone. And here I want to give a shout out to Kelly Robertson's beautiful work on rocks and an essay called Exemplary Rocks. So, you know, in the Middle Ages, rocks, which are these most material kind of thing, even they were thought to have virtue, which here, rather than meaning moral purity, means something like power or agency. Rocks were classified in lapidaries, which are specialized encyclopedias devoted to describing the varieties of rocks and their respective virtues. It was understood then that rocks could do things, that contact with them or merely being in their presence could affect the human body or the surrounding environment. In addition to these physical effects, rocks could carry moral meaning too. And then, of course, this idea that physical things have agency extends in medieval Christian religious culture to the widespread belief in the power of relics and religious images. Medieval ideas about materiality were very complex and had a lot in common with, you could even say they anticipated, contemporary philosophical notions of material agency as explored in work like Jane Bennett's Vibrant Matter.
That's a really salient example of the sort of context-specific way in which we can study animism, especially in medieval contexts. When it comes to cross-cultural studies on animism, though, I'm wondering how we might learn responsibly from indigenous cultures.
I've been reading Robin Wall Kimmerer's Braiding Sweetgrass, which I really recommend if you haven't encountered it yet. Kimmerer is a biologist by training, but she balances her commitment to Western science with an equal commitment to indigenous knowledge. As a graduate student, she was discouraged from approaching the study of botany by drawing on her Potawatomi heritage, but eventually she was able to, quote, this is her term, braid together the two epistemologies, showing that both are valuable, both are mutually informing. I think this is a good lesson for thinking across many different kinds of boundaries, Western, indigenous, sciences, humanities, contemporary, medieval, etc. What if we could think of these relationships as partnerships, as ecologies, rather than binaries? There's a section in the first chapter of Kimmerer's book where she describes her struggle to learn the language of her ancestors. She writes a lot about how the affordances of various languages affect the way we think about our environments and relationships within them. Potawatomi, for example, has way more verbs than nouns. And there are verbs for things like being a bay or being a Saturday. She talks about the way English is a language of objects, while Potawatomi is a language of subjects or agents. And this is a worldview she describes as a, quote, grammar of animacy. For me, reading her account has helped to think more deeply about how language structures our assumptions about the world. Work like this, like Kimmerer's, has a lot, I think, to teach us about the limitations of any one epistemology, the language of any one discipline or historical orientation will create blind spots, right? And inculcate biases and assumptions that another disciplinary discourse might be able to redress. And so for that reason, we have to braid them, as Kimmerer suggests. None is privileged, both are necessary.
We started our conversation talking about really specific pieces of the Middle English language that can help us think about the relationality between types of environments and ecosystems. Natural, built, social, micro, macro. So in that way, thinking about affordances of language even becomes a tool for thinking about how interdisciplinarity is more than just an option that literary scholars can draw upon, but rather vital, like no pun intended there, for avoiding those blind spots that you mentioned. That's one of the main things that initially drew me to environmental humanities, which I think tries to seriously consider how fields that we see as distinct, like STEM and humanities, are not as distinct in actuality as the university system's organization into separate colleges would have us believe. Fundamentally, I think that our areas of literary study and a STEM field like biology or chemistry are all dealing with how things interact with other things, whether it be to cultural or literary forces, to atoms, to periodic elements, and so on and so forth. In different ways, obviously, yes, but perhaps not totally uncomplementary or unrelated. I think that environmental humanities is increasingly starting to think about situating itself purposefully as deeply interdisciplinary in a way that reflects that approach I was discussing in both its methodology and in its pedagogy. And we have been talking about the relationality between so-called natural and built environment. As we've been discussing in these various ways, they deeply affect the other and in turn deeply affect the humans that move through them. And that is not an unfamiliar concept to us as 21st century humans, as climate change is drastically changing the weather and the environments around us, and this in turn affects the buildings we live in, etc. But practically speaking, when it comes to literary criticism, folks who do eco theory and folks who do architectural theory, I don't think, like, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think they're generally seen as working on the same spectrum or even in a related field, strangely. I wonder how your theoretical subfields tend to situate themselves disciplinarily, Amy, or how these topics work within them.
Environmental humanities really does allow for a kind of multidisciplinary approach to studies and inquiries of the past, in particular, and also gives us a real material way to understand the consequences of climate catastrophe, for instance, and our individual and collective relationships to and in space. To get to the heart of your question, how I characterize or categorize myself, it's interesting because I don't often see myself as somebody doing architectural history. And I think this is because traditionally this kind of work is more concerned with holding hard disciplinary boundaries, and that doesn't really align with my academic ethos. For me, this is quite perplexing because architecture is situated at this nexus between humanities and STEM inherently. It's predicated upon this knowledge or sort of technologies of engineering, mathematics, and construction, while also at the same time, it engages humanistic rubrics of art, design, and craft. Even Vitruvius's ancient architectural text, De Architectura, which is a very important treatise in the history of Western architecture and the sort of bedrock of Western architecture, speaks about how the builder needs to know and or operate with an understanding of all of these disciplinary categories: engineering, design, ornament, medicine, climate, among various others. And so I found it sort of ironic that there hasn't been a huge move in architectural history to think more capaciously about these kinds of intersectional approaches to studies of space, bodies, and environment. This isn't to say either that there aren't really forward-thinking architectural historians who are doing exciting multidisciplinary work.
Are there any standout examples of that type of approach that you have come across?
Yes. Mark Wigley, for instance, has produced really insightful research on the ways in which building theory intersects with concepts of health and medicine, while the work of architectural historians Maple Wilson and Irene Chang and Charles Davis have examined the intersection of race, racecraft, and architecture in modern buildings from the Enlightenment to our current moment. Art historian Roland Betancourt and literary scholar Umbreen Databoy have also done some really fascinating work on the intersection of architecture and race in Constantinople and Istanbul in their work on geography and mapping in pre-modernity. And here I'm also separating the work of art historians from architectural historians, precisely because art historians have and do produce vibrant work that is deeply intersectional. And in large part, this is due to pre-modern critical race scholars like Kim Hall, Naomi Nidier, Leah Markey, Letha Chien, who all rightfully encourage art historians and literary scholars to think about disciplinary formations in our studies of race, gender, sexuality, class, religion, etc., and pre-modernity generally. All of this is to say that there are, of course, folks who have and are moving medieval visual studies in a kind of direction akin to what we're talking about with environmental humanities, but I do absolutely think it is the work of architectural historians to catch up to other theoretical subfields. This makes me think and sort of reflect, you know, I don't typically categorize myself as somebody doing environmental humanities, but after this conversation, I think I might need to reconsider. Becky, I'm curious about your take on this. How does this identifier of environmental humanities fit into your research and or teaching?
As it happens, I'm teaching a course right now on medieval and contemporary apocalypticism that was inspired by the work of my friend Shannon Geik. Her book, Apocalyptic Ecologies, is coming out really soon, and she's just been really wonderful as an interlocutor in these sorts of eco-critical and issues of environmental humanities. So in the course, my students and I are thinking about representations of catastrophe and how we might use historical examples to think about climate change. One of the first things I did in the course was introduce students to the concept of the environmental humanities, because I want them to ask, you know, why study the humanities now? What can we do as humanists? What skills and sensibilities can we bring to the challenges of climate change? It seems to me that the environmental humanities as a discipline is an important answer to a lot of the questions that we've been talking about today. You know, it fundamentally promotes a non-hierarchical worldview, refusing binaries like nature, culture, but also human slash animal, Western slash indigenous, and even humanities slash science. These are all binaries that privilege the quote upper term and suggest an impassable division between them. Instead, the environmental humanities envisions these entities as coexisting within a network or mesh, a partnership of give and take, reciprocity, and co-becoming.
Are there ways this might help us discuss medieval studies and its place in the humanities specifically?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot, actually. You know, as medievalists, we're often anxious about the, quote, relevance of our field. I mean, obviously, we're not as important as the scientists, but even compared with the work of our colleagues in later literary fields, our studies are not seen as, you know, quote, unquote, useful. We're expendable. When medievalists retire, they're rarely replaced on many campuses. So we're always asking ourselves some version of the question, you know, what do we have to say to the contemporary world to contribute to the urgent problems that face us, whether that's climate change or the continuing effects of systemic racism? So one answer to these questions is to stress the value of historical knowledge as a warning to the future. You know, this saying, if we don't know the past, we're doomed to repeat its mistakes, right? Another answer is to say simply nothing. Our work isn't useful, not in an applied sense. And that precisely, paradoxically, is its use. I think both of these responses have merits, but I also think that notions like the non-hierarchical mindset of the environmental humanities and the concept of the divis, the boundary that is also a point of contact, might suggest other ways to think about the relative value of medieval studies in the university. Right now, I think we're in a system where there's a hierarchy that puts the sciences, you know, STEM on top, and then a little later come the humanities, which in turn has its own scale of value that places the more contemporary, quote unquote, relevant periods first, those that speak directly to our urgent concerns with gender and sexuality, race, identity, labor, globalization, climate change, and so forth. Medieval studies tends in this kind of a scale to land down at the basement level as being niche, retrograde, irrelevant to contemporary concerns. I'd like us to reimagine the scale of value precisely not as a scale, but more like a web. The metaphors we use matter. This means taking the dividing slash of binary thinking and turning it into a porous divise. It's still a distinction, a disciplinary boundary. It's there, to be sure, but one that allows cross-communication. And just as technological innovations aren't going to solve our problems without the historical, cultural, local, and rhetorical knowledge of the humanists, humanist knowledge isn't complete without the long view that medievalists and other earliests can offer. And this isn't just because in some vague way, you know, we need to know our history. It's also because history teaches us that the way things are now aren't the way they always were, nor the way they have to be in the future. Ideas, habits, practices, even what seems natural, always has a history.
Thanks so much to the both of you for offering your insights and expertise on all things natural and built environments in medieval contexts. I'm especially grateful to have had the opportunity to learn from you and to share this space.
Me too. I totally second that. Thank you both for talking to me today.
Yes, what an amazing experience this has been. I'm truly honored to be here.
We'd also like to give a special thank you to listeners for learning alongside us and to the Multicultural Middle Ages podcast team for giving us the platform to discuss these topics.
This has been an episode of the Multicultural Middle Ages, an anthology-style podcast series sponsored by the Medieval Academy of America. Season 3 was produced by Will Beatty, Jonathan Correa-Reyes, Reed O'Mara, and Logan Quigley, with music by Anna O'Connell. For more information on the MMA podcast, follow the links in the episode description and consider subscribing to keep up with new episodes.